In Autobiography of a Yogi, there's a story told about the death and rebirth of Kashi. Kashi was a student in Master's school. He was a young boy. And Master tells the story about how he was sitting with many of the students, and the students were asking him questions. Will I be a monk? Where will my life take me? What will happen? And he tells one story of a young boy who was determined to be a renunciate. And instead, he said, no, in your future, a beautiful bride awaits you. Actually, I believe it was another man who was speaking at that point. But there were different questions asked. And each one was told, you'll do this, you'll do that. But then when Kashi asked a question about his future, I believe Master said to him, well, you won't have a future because you're going to die very soon. And, of course, the boy was quite horrified by that, but he was primarily horrified because he was a spiritually minded person and he had found Yogananda as his spiritual guide, and he didn't want to be taken away from what he'd gained. And as the story is told, for weeks, Kashi begged Yogananda to promise that after he was reborn, that Master would find him and bring him back to the spiritual path. And Master tells the story that he was extremely reluctant to make such a promise. Whether or not it was really a challenge for Master or not, that's not the issue. He just was very reluctant. He said until he saw that Kashi, as he put it, was near the breaking point with the tension. And so then he promised, I promise I will find you. So, I mean, imagine, where in this whole universe, would he be and how would you come to him? But Yogananda had promised. And then he talks about, but then he also said to Kashi, there was another dramatic part of it. If you can stay on the school grounds and not leave this school, perhaps this fate won't occur to you. And then Yogananda himself had to go away for a month. And during that month, Kashi's father came and wanted to take him home, I believe, to Calcutta to see his mother. And Kashi said, I cannot, I will not leave with you. And for 2 weeks, his father kept insisting that just for a few days I have to take you. And finally, Kashi couldn't resist his father's insistence. In any culture, it would be difficult, but in the Indian culture, you do not defy your father. And the father insisted, took Kashi away. Kashi contracted cholera and died. And Yogananda himself said when he saw Kashi's father, he said, you have killed my boy. But he then saw the father was already so guilt-stricken that Master said no more. Think about all the parts of that story. First of all, here's Kashi, just a young boy looking forward to the rest of his life. He asks his guru what seems to be a very innocent question, and all of a sudden he's told, no, nothing is going to happen the way you expect it to happen. I mean, think about that if that happens to you. Just be ready for that. Imagine asking a question, an innocent question, from someone who you know can answer it, and getting an answer so unexpected. Where will your consciousness go? How will you accept that? And Master tells us that Kashi was concerned about nothing except the continuation of his spiritual life. If we really think about birth and death from the point of view of reincarnation, it's inconvenient. That's what it becomes. It's very inconvenient. When a woman was dying of AIDS in our Ananda community, she'd had several death and return experiences, and the concept of dying was completely without fear to her. Living was a bit of a problem. As she put it, it's like having a bad case of the flu all the time. She said, how much longer? She said, to Swami, do I need to keep on? He said, well, as long as that body is spiritually useful to you. All that the body is just a way of focusing our energy, of following our path, of doing our sadhana, of loving other people, of refining our consciousness. As long as that body, as being within that body, you can continue to make spiritual progress, you should keep it. Because otherwise, he said, you're just going to have to go through all the bother of getting another one. And you're going to have to be an infant again, and who knows who your parents will be and what kind of problems you'll have. And you have to learn everything that we have to learn about being a human being. You have to go through adolescence. You have to find your independent life. And then you get your guru just to bring you back to here. So why would you want to do that? You know, as long as you can keep making spiritual progress, hold on. And she did hold on for quite a few years more and found it deeply beneficial. She grew a great deal spiritually during that period of time. So Kashi, his concern was entirely and only that. I found my spiritual path and I don't want to lose it in the forgetfulness that happens between incarnations. So then Master... So then Kashi is faced with the fact that his father comes and he suddenly, his guru's point of view is pitted against his father's point of view. Now how many times have we faced realities like that where what we know we're supposed to do spiritually is challenged by someone who may have authority over us or power over us or emotional hold over us or an actual duty, but how does that duty compare to our spiritual duty? You know, how do we decide what is correct? When do we give in? When do we merely... I watched Swami Kriyananda in a most interesting circumstance, which was the situation when Ananda was in litigation and we had been sued by Self-Realization Fellowship, and Self-Realization Fellowship had lost all their exclusive rights to Master's teachings. That happened in 1994. This lawsuit went on to 2002, but by 1994, it was done. Copyrights, their copyrights canceled, their trademarks canceled, all rights, Yogananda's teaching and his name and his image and his likeness belonged to the world, the courts had declared. The appeal system and various things keep it going for a long time. There was only one option left to them, and our lawyers told us and warned us, which is a concept called tarnishment, which is if it could be proven that Ananda as a whole was morally reprehensible, and therefore any association in the mind of the public between Self-Realization Fellowship and Ananda would tarnish the reputation of Self-Realization Fellowship, there was the possibility they could still suppress our right to represent Master. So Swami said, get ready. And sure enough, by the end of 1994, we were in a different lawsuit. And that lawsuit was complete character assassination. It was literally a boilerplate anti-cult lawsuit that had literally been filed against other groups. And just the names were just pulled out and our names were put in. And in a few places, the other names were actually left in by accident. So just make a list of everything that we would be charged for: sexual abuse, financial abuse, power abuse, gender abuse, employment abuse. You know, just make a list like that. It was all their brainwashing, everything. So we're starting in on this lawsuit. Swami Kriyananda was in Europe, and we hired an attorney. Swami came home, and he immediately knew that that attorney didn't believe in our cause, didn't have the refinement of consciousness, and didn't like Swami. Treated him like a guilty man, that he was going to do his duty. He was a criminal defense attorney who gets guilty people a fair trial. So that's what he sort of set out to do with us. Swami Kriyananda said to us, this is not going to work. This man is the wrong man for us. And Maya being what it is, those of us who had together made that decision and committed a lot of money to it, didn't listen. And we had this day where Swami was trying to tell us, and we were not listening. And then even in a matter so important, Swami just put up his hands and stepped back. You can struggle against Divine Mother's will to a certain point, and then you just have to say, this is what is trying to happen. And as a consequence of that man, it was a bloodbath against us. And there was a point at which Swami saw it coming. But rather than push against us, he said, well, I always thought it was so ironic, because the whole charge was that he was a ruthless dictator. And in this situation, where everything was at stake, if we didn't see it of our own free will, he still stood back and just let us learn. You know? So it's not so simple always, even for someone like Swami. You know, when the forces are arrayed against you, sometimes you have to stop and ask, when do I simply go it by alone, and when do I just say, this is where the river of life is taking me? So there we have Kashi. His guru has told him, you must stay here. His father will not relent. And eventually he goes with him. Fate was stronger. It's just, I don't have good answers today. I'm just amazed by this whole story. Isn't it amazing what it's telling us, you know? Jyotish remarked recently in a completely unrelated situation, very simply, life is messy. And our decisions are not clear-cut or necessarily wrong, even though they turn out chaotically, even though we lose what we wanted. It doesn't do us any good to lament and lament and lament and lament, oh, if only I could have done it differently, you know, like that. So Kashi goes off, and he gets cholera and he dies. Can you imagine the father? For whom were all these lessons? For the father to listen to his son? You know, for Kashi to not listen to his father? And then Master has to find him. And the story, it's such a great story. And Master talks about how he uses his hands as antennas, and he starts looking for the vibrations of Kashi, and he uses his heart as a receiving station. And for months, he said he was the humorous object of his friends' consternation as he would stand in places looking for Kashi. And all he needed was a pyramid on his head, and he would have looked just perfect, wouldn't it? Of course, he was a sadhu at that point in orange robes. And then he describes, he was in, I believe, Varanasi, and he turns a certain direction, and this emanation starts. And he hears what he says is Kashi's characteristic horse. He had a horse, sort of a hoarse tone of voice. And Master said, Kashi maintained that voice in order so that Master would recognize him. And Kashi, from the womb of his new mother, feels Master's presence and starts calling to him. And so Master, you know, follows down, knocks on the door of a total stranger's house. You know, is your wife pregnant? Has she been pregnant for about 6 months? You know, this man looks at this Swami, but of course this is India, and he is a Swami, so strange things happen. Yes, as a matter of fact, she is. So he comes in and he tells them, shows him a picture. This is the child you're going to have. Isn't it marvelous? You know, we just live in this dull planet and just go out to Starbucks and have coffee and go home. It's like there's so much going on around us that we're not paying any attention to. So in fact, he said Kashi was born and looked very similar to what he had looked like. And when the two of them met, when Kashi was just an infant, there was this instant recognition between them, even though a helpless infant can't articulate what he wants to say and can't get up and run and to Master and touch his feet. But the full consciousness is there. So there he is. Imagine also the anxiety of Kashi himself. You know, will Master keep his promise? He probably was not restful in that womb for those first 6 months, you know, just waiting. But the relief when Master came in the door and he knew, oh, I've been found. And then he tells later that as he was a notably spiritual person, and when he was a teenager, Master sent him to the Himalayas, where he went to live with a Himalayan yogi. Babaji, you wonder? It's not mentioned in the story, but you're just reading that and you think, what Himalayan yogi? But of course, there are many. But this is really the true trajectory of life. And everything else we're doing is just entertainment, really. Petty enthusiasms that we're filling in. Everything is about this divine pull that's just always there, always looking for us. And we ourselves, we get so distracted. But there's really just this one pulse. This is in Indian music when they sing and they improvise and they just the ragas go in so many directions, but you have someone always playing the tambura. And it's just this, just endlessly repeating. And no matter what happens around it, it never shifts. And you see that one person, if it's being played live, you know, just this incredible chaos is going on around them with the sitar players and the banging and the dancing and the voices, whatever it might be. This person is just always like this. Because it's a picture. It's a picture exactly of what our lives are like. All of this karma is always having to be dealt with. Swami Kriyananda, in the middle of that, I mean, it was a horrible, vivid, seemingly never-ending piece of karma that just never went away. And Swami was just in the middle of it. He knew it would just be a disaster. One day he said, you know, the law of averages says that at least some things are going to go your way. And when we were in the middle of that particular lawsuit, everything went against us. He said, when everything goes against you, you know that Divine Mother is doing it. Which was a little comforting in a certain way. She just, there's a certain tapasya, there's a certain penance that has to be paid. Swamiji said many times in the middle of that and afterwards, he said basically he was doing penance for the whole yoga movement in America. It's almost very difficult to comprehend, isn't it? Because there was, at that time, a certain chaos setting in. And it wasn't merely that, you know, anti-cult accusations were being leveled literally at every ashram in America, most of whom folded under the pressure or in some way radically changed themselves. But prior to that, and this was interesting, Swami said this dilution was beginning to set in. This slightly, what do we really need with gurus? Why should we really concentrate so hard on doing one thing? Why is self-restraint so needed? And Swami said there was an insidious influence of psychology. Not that psychology is itself insidious, but it was an insidious influence of psychology into spirituality, which is, you know, my rights, my boundaries, what you did to me, you should be punished for what you did to me. Instead of Divine Mother is in charge. Karma is always fair. I have to take responsibility for my own actions and for the consequence of my own actions. Of course, that doesn't mean other people shouldn't take responsibility for theirs. But the whole premise of the spiritual path is it's about your actions and your consciousness. It's not about I'm a victim of somebody else. And the whole anti-cult thing, the whole ridiculous accusations against us was this perfectly capable adult woman who'd proved herself capable of doing anything she wanted, whenever she wanted, without regard for anyone, suddenly is this victim, this terrible, weak, impossible victim who'd been literally brainwashed in the first 15 minutes of meditation one and remained so for 7 years. I mean, unbelievable, except it was happening. But it was happening also in lots of ashrams. Just this sudden assertion of my egoic rights. And Swami said the whole movement will go to nothing if we go that way. We think we're modernizing it, but we're actually eviscerating it. He said someone has to stand against it. He said, and I'm going to be the one. On what level were these things happening? You know, we just evaluate life in such an obvious way. He did that, she did that, this happened, that happened. I read this on the internet, this is what's true. And we don't understand that the hand of God is just moving this all. Moving every bit of it. Swamiji said in the midst of that, when it all went to such a horrible position, He said, sometimes you go to battle for righteousness and you have a victory. He said, sometimes God needs a sacrifice. God needs a sacrifice. I can't answer what that means. But sometimes tapasya is needed. Think about all the Christians that were thrown to the lions. You know, why didn't God save those Christians? Were they not rescued at the last moment? Why did so many of them die? Swamiji remarked in a completely unrelated context. He said, the power of their courage in the face of death, that's what created Christianity. I mean, it was just a cosmic force that I believe in this so much that I will literally walk into the lion's den. And that kind of courage and something with that much power that people will do that, it creates a hallelujah that goes out through all creation. And the loss of a life means nothing. But the end of an incarnation, it means nothing. We think it's so important. But as a very wise Buddhist teacher put it, we think each lifetime is a separate event. These are not separate events. If today you need to do something heroic, if you need to rush out into the road and save someone from being hit by a car, and maybe you break your own leg in the process, you would consider it well spent. So if in this incarnation you have to sacrifice a great deal in order to save something that's powerful to you, if only your own integrity and relationship to it, merely because the next life you don't remember, it doesn't mean that that life wasn't well spent. You know, the world is a very, very different place, and it behooves us in every situation to lift our consciousness to the highest possible level. Not why is this happening, but why is this happening? What divine thing is trying to take place here, and help me to find it? And sometimes the prayer is, I have no idea what's going on, Lord, I really don't. But I'll just put one foot in front of the other, and in every small decision, I'll do the best that I can do. Swamiji says, if you have strength and opportunity to do something constructive in the direction that you're trying to go, then by all means do it. And if you don't, then just leave it in God's hands. When Swamiji looked at all of us and saw that we were going to make a catastrophic decision, but the only way that he could have changed it, it would have been to batter us down and literally declare what we were going to do against our own judgment. He said, I don't have a position in this. If I had something I could do, and I've tried, essentially, he said that in his own heart, I've tried, and now I just have to put it in God's hands. You can see young Kashi trying to tell his father, no, I can't go with you. And at a certain point, who knows what came to him. But then his father took him. Then he had to go on to the next cycle. Life is this very subtle balance between concentrating in the moment, doing the best you can, and then never thinking about it again, in the sense of recognizing God's role in all of this. We live in the palm of his hand. We move as best we can within that palm, but it is he who takes us. God bless you.